Henry II of England and his wife, Eleanor of Aquitaine, have created and ruled the Plantagenet Empire, the most dynamic, wealthiest, and most powerful kingdom in Western Europe. But the Plantagenets are rarely at peace, and Henry's temper and ego has long troubled his family and his people, from the shocking martyrdom of Thomas Becket to the vicious Great Rebellion that saw Eleanor sent to prison for 15 years. Meanwhile, their brilliant, avaricious, rebellious children have grown, fought, ruled, married, and even died, so that of his five sons, only two survive, Richard Lionheart and John Lackland. Now, as the 12th century enters its final decade, Henry himself dies, leaving his great legacy poised at the edge of great success or great failure. Here's the story of what happens as Richard and John take their turns on the Plantagenet throne.
Welcome back to Season 3 of Lion's Forge. My name is Becket, and I want to tell you a story, an epic true story of five kings and the Lion Queen. Season 3, Episode 14. My heart is filled with gladness. Lionheart returned to London 4 years after he had left it. Happy throngs surged through the streets, celebrating their king, and bells rang out from 100 London churches. Richard's crusade, Richard's ransom from captivity in Germany, may have cost his people a fortune, but they seemed more than willing to have paid it. One of the few who didn't share the general giddiness was John Lackland, who by then could have had the word traitor branded across his forehead. John's life had deteriorated when word arrived that Richard would indeed be coming home. Lackland had already been excommunicated by England's bishops, his estates declared forfeit by the Royal Council. Worst of all, Richard was reportedly coming to deal with him personally. Despite Lionheart's forced stay in Germany, his reputation as the greatest warrior of his day was undimmed. He took the rebel castle of Nottingham, a Lackland stronghold, within 2 days. And there's a story that one of John's followers literally died of fright when news reached him that the king was on his way. That gentleman may have gotten off easy, given that Richard was rarely solicitous of rebels. He had a history of battering their castles, hanging soldiers caught on the wrong side, and levying punishing fines. This round, he had one aristocratic traitor skinned alive, and starved another to death in a Plantagenet dungeon. There had been enough and more than enough treason in the years he'd been gone. Now the king's order would be restored, by force wherever necessary. Before he left to hunt down the quaking John, there was a little time set aside for governance, and it does look as if every effort was made to get it done as quickly as humanly possible. Richard dealt with everything from that old favorite appointing sheriffs to revisions of the tax code in a mere 4 exhausting days with his council. There was also good reason for Richard to go out of his way to look the part of the monarch of the Plantagenet Empire again, an idea that might have originated with his mother. Cooks, bakers, heralds, clothmakers, bishops, choirs, bell ringers, poets, jugglers, and liegemen were summoned to a brilliant festival at Old Winchester, where Richard was re-crowned before his people in a way that would drown the awful mental image of Richard in prison, Richard kneeling to the Holy Roman Emperor. He had to be seen wearing his crown, clothed in magnificent robes, attended by no less than 13 bishops, lavishly feeding the multitude, pouring wine, receiving hosannas in the street. To pay for it all, Richard reverted to the tried and true. He again sold royal offices, particularly insisting that sheriffs, the backbone of the tax collection system, pay for the privilege of retaining office. Men who believed they already occupied that lucrative niche of local government were unpleasantly surprised to find that the king didn't necessarily agree. If loyalists groaned, rebels were much worse off. Anyone who had displayed a lack of loyalty in the years after Lionheart had sailed for Syria was fined with a very heavy hand. Given Prince John's avid and not entirely unsuccessful efforts to promote treason among the barons, the Plantagenet treasury began to recover. Nor did Lionheart ignore the gaping holes in his English government. What the king needed was someone of Thomas Becket's caliber, and Richard found him in another Archbishop of Canterbury. Richard's new Chief Justiciar and Chancellor of England was one Hubert Walter. The reason we would care is that Walter, in his mid-30s, did what Thomas Becket had declared impossible. He combined the roles of Archbishop of Canterbury, Chief Justiciar, and Lord Chancellor, and did it superbly, beginning the transformation of 12th century England into a modernized state of regulations, systems, and records. It was the task of a lifetime, and Walter, who'd already served in Richard's crusade and helped broker Richard's ransom, would go on to work himself nearly to death in service to the Plantagenets. And so it was that after little more than 2 hectic months in England, Richard left London on a day in May 1194. Lionheart had little emotional attachment to England, but even if he had been desolate at the thought of leaving it, the spring of 1194 would still have seen him heading to France. Philip Augustus was making trouble again, aided and abetted by nobles who had never much cared for Richard. As for our impatient king, his brain working over everything he faced on the other side of the channel, he was about to pass through a door he would never re-enter. Richard Lionheart, one of the most famous of all English kings, would never again leave his French lands. He would die as he lived, in the open, under the sky, at war, far away. But not yet. Lionheart quickly used money, his favorite thing, to solve a nagging problem of kings, the antiquated feudal concept of short terms of personal service from vassals, which all too often left warring monarchs with too few men-at-arms, just when they were needed to teach somebody a lesson. Even if it stressed his treasury, Richard paid good money for knights who pledged a year's service at a time, for foot soldiers from Wales, for crossbowmen from Italy and archers from Syria. He also handsomely paid his dreaded mercenary routiers, little more than gangsters for the most part, recruited into Richard's infantry but then largely left to their own devices. Crude bullies, rapacious, pitiless, their reputation terrified everyone in their path. One of Richard's favorite captains, Mercadier, himself a mercenary, led them on a very slack rein. After all, they'd already shrugged off the church's automatic excommunication of anyone sinful enough to trade murder for money. They were going to hell anyway, so effective methods of discipline were limited. If they were in your neighborhood, you were well advised to be elsewhere, and to count on finding very little that was recognizable when you got back. Richard needed Mercadier and needed mercenaries because in these post-imprisonment 1190s, dynastic fights between Richard and Philip Augustus ebbed and flowed, bloody tides that swept over villages and farms, fields and forests, like plays on a gigantic chessboard. The main arenas were Richard's always stormy southern lands of Anjou and the Aquitaine, along with the northern French-Norman border, where Philip Augustus was determined to be master. There were so many ways for war to break out. Some hothead would attack a castle that owed fealty to the other side. A weak fortress would become an easy target. Loyalists of Prince A would go after loyalists of Prince B. Messengers from the victim's stronghold would then be dispatched at speed, looking for the Baron's lord, who in turn was obliged by the rules of fealty to provide assistance to his vassal. If nothing else sufficed, you could simply claim, however untrue it might be, that you'd been attacked, as Philip did before going after Venuy and Evreux, shouting that English bandits had raided his lands. Straw roofs would be burned off, fences knocked aside, water wheels broken, pig yards and hen houses stripped, crops trampled to sodden nothing, wells fouled, trees gone for an army's campfires. Wounds would either heal fast or kill you. Fevers advanced and retreated with the moon, the rain, the undrained marshes. Sometimes the castle fell, only to be recaptured the following month. Sometimes the besiegers were driven off. Sometimes nobility sat together and made bargains, which might be flagrantly dishonored by the time the ink had dried. Little had changed in 100 years, or 500 for that matter, as rich men fought for more, and poor men tried to subsist on the rest. Violence was vicious and merciless, intensified by a notable lack of squeamishness among royalty of the day. Historian Peter Ackroyd comments, "When one English king was asked if he regretted the thousands of soldiers he'd sent to slaughter, he remarked that they would thank him when they were in heaven." If you were a prince, what happened to mere mortals was irrelevant, since the exhilaration of the fight was what you were born for. The troubadour Bertrand de Born wrote, with what we'd consider entirely misplaced glee, "It gives me great joy to see knights and horses in battle array, and it delights me when the skirmishes scatter people in herds. My heart is filled with gladness when I see strong castles besieged, and their stockades broken and overrun. And I like to see the lord who is foremost in the attack mounted, armed, and fearless. No man wins respect until he has given and taken many a blow." It's hard to assess how the victims might feel about all this, but contingents loyal to Richard and to Philip Augustus collided time after time as spring and then summer drifted across the Norman countryside in 1194. We have small stories of those days of violence and treachery, when the winning side could change by the hour. One time, the French were heading back toward Paris after a brief set-to that ruined the lives of only a few dozen men and their families. Richard surprised them by overrunning their rear guard near the little town of Vendôme, famous for its possession of a crystal vial containing a tear shed by Jesus. The English captured money, animals, and equipment, along with a cart full of interesting documents, that laid out which of Richard's supposedly loyal lords had recently pledged themselves to Philip, and which of Richard's possessions they were to receive in return. Then there was Verneuil, west of Paris, under French attack. Philip lost an entire train of siege equipment that tried to flee the scene upon Richard's arrival. It's said that Lionheart was so pleased at his victory that he kissed each of the defenders and promised them rewards big enough to turn up as line items in the next annual Norman Treasury report. Yet despite the flash and flare, very little came of it all. One historian has mildly observed, "Great border castles fell, were recovered, and fell again. What was lost in all the fighting, all the shuffling of territory and property, was economic and political stability in Normandy." It was a fact that would come to torment the Plantagenets in the years just ahead. On the other hand, matters were settled, at least for the time being, between John Lackland and his frightening brother. Once he learned that Richard had truly come back, John hastily stopped playing the princely warrior and sought the first opportunity available to fall at Lionheart's feet. The belief is that Eleanor drove the reconciliation between the brothers, one a famous warrior, the other a treasonous braggart. Richard apparently considered 27-year-old John nothing but what he called a boy who'd been misled by evil advisors. Duly chastened, John would now fight on Richard's side against Philip Augustus, so recently John's closest friend. That about-face, as usual, punished civilians the most. Take the Norman farming town of Evreux, an antique that had seen Julius Caesar's legions in their day. The place was stunned when John clattered into the square with its lovely cathedral and ordered his men to hunt down all the French residents, who were summarily executed as a sign of Lackland's newborn allegiance to Richard. The French garrison surrendered. It was invited to dinner with John. They were murdered at table. Evreux, so recently a pleasant country village, became a medieval slaughterhouse. Once Philip Augustus heard the stammered reports about what had happened to the French, he drove John out and then pillaged, raped, and killed all the resident Normans. Crows must have blackened the skies over that haunted place for days, but Philip probably just shrugged. He had once said that people were little more to him than dishcloths, to be used and discarded as the need arose. And so it went, on and on, numbing to read in the historical record, until a combination of battle fatigue and attendant misery reached a level even kings couldn't entirely ignore. In July 1194, the two sides agreed to a truce that was to last for well over a year, throughout the entire fighting season of 1195. It was a blessed guarantee that life might actually go on undisturbed until the spring of 1196, since winter was always the dead season when battles were insupportable. However, as was usually the case, the seeds of the next conflict were planted even as the current one came to its end. Richard, who hadn't been directly involved in the negotiations, was infuriated to learn that Philip had bargained to keep virtually every castle he had taken, while Richard could only rebuild 4. The one-sided, and therefore despised, treaty was nonetheless signed. Messengers made their way through the countryside to spread the welcome news that there would be no more fighting, that planting and harvesting in France and in Normandy could go on without terror of pillage and destruction. Whether anyone believed them is debatable. Truce or no truce, there were constant bristling skirmishes to set pieces in their place for the full-on war that would inevitably come. Richard went about his own harvest season, gathering in money. He imposed on his Angevin and Aquitanian officials the same regimen he had established in England. If you wanted a new office, or even wanted to keep the one you had best appear in town with your palm filled with coins. An entirely new tax was invented, applied to the value of trade moving through Plantagenet ports. He borrowed from everyone who would lend, and then someone in his government had a creative brainstorm. Tournaments. Monetize tournaments. They'd been outlawed by Henry Plantagenet in his lands, and the church had always considered them sinful. But people loved them, thus lighting the path toward a delightfully lucrative new source of income. Lionheart, who preferred real warfare to tournament play, now agreed to permit tournaments, under close official scrutiny, provided, of course, that anyone wishing to sponsor one paid for the appropriate license. Enthusiastic aristocrats promptly sent their people to the county seat to apply. The arrangement was successful on several levels, raising not only cash, but, according to the pleased William Marshall, the quality of England's knights. As apple trees blossomed in the blissfully quiet spring of 1195, and money began to refill the exchequer, Richard had little to do. One historian refers to the time as the most peaceful of Richard's life. he placidly went to Mass every day, accepting the criticism of his spiritual life in good grace. Attention to his spiritual life perhaps was the lever beneath further softening toward his brother. John would get no castles, but lands and revenues were restored to him. Relations with bastard half-brother Geoffrey, never warm, became a trifle less cool. The hostages who'd been held in Germany to guarantee the payment of Richard's ransom even came home, winning macabre deliverance thanks to Leopold of Austria's gruesome death by gangrene. Most surprising, there's evidence that Richard spent rare time with his wife, who essentially lived entirely apart from him. We think they bought a house together near Le Mans, abnormally domestic for the two of them. Despite such apparent amity, they never would get to the point of living together and wouldn't even trouble to see each other again for several years. And then, the 38-year-old king, worn down by a lifetime of war, of life in the open, bad food, bad water, cold, wet, repeated illnesses, wounds, and captivity, became very ill. They believed he was dying. The woman at his bedside wasn't Berengaria, but Eleanor, who must have driven the doctors and priests surrounding her boy to madness. As it happened, fate smiled at Lionheart once more. Rather than dying, as everyone expected, he recovered. As his health improved, he received a French delegation bearing an extraordinary proposal from their king, that the Plantagenets and the French each choose 5 knights who would fight a dynastic tournament. The winning side would be considered the ultimate victor in the endless warfare between the two. One rarely sees much evidence of Richard's sense of humor, but there's a glint in his counterproposal that he would agree, provided that each side be headed by its king. The French apparently failed to see the fun to be had. Philip withdrew the offer. Then, ambassadors arrived from Richard's liege lord, the Holy Roman Emperor, who was fresh from his glorious successes in Sicily. He demanded that his vassal Richard, buttressed by a German army, invade France. Philip Augustus, who soon found out about it, was both frightened and furious. A meeting with Richard was hastily arranged at the Norman town of Vaudreuil, a recent French conquest that lay about halfway between Paris and the coast. One can imagine the scene. Tangles of knights with their horses and their banners. Covered wooden carts carrying the ladies of both courts, officials, and clerks. The usual sprinkling of abbots and churchmen. Senior nobles attending their kings. Gaping townspeople. Servants raising tents, trumpeters and drummers, while pigs and dogs looking for scraps wandered through the crowds. After the usual toasting and feasting demanded by the rules of civility, Philip and Richard would have gotten down to it. The Vaudreuil negotiations, however, were not quite what they appeared. Even as they ate, warily toasted each other, and talked together, Philip had miners tunneling under the walls of Vaudreuil Castle, a small local fortress that had been won by the French. Philip had reasonable cause to fear that Richard would try to take it back. Rather than lose it, Philip had decided to simply blow it up. Regrettably for the congenial spirit presumably intended during the meeting, all heads must have swiveled as one at the sound of the walls collapsing prematurely, the miners having been rather too diligent about their labors. Richard, of course, immediately slammed his fist on the table and walked out, declaring the talks at an end. The Vaudreuil Conference of 1195 can thus be counted as something less than a success for diplomacy, but noteworthy in the history of medieval explosives. Normally, Vaudreuil would have been the signal for warfare to break out in a dozen new places, but it was superseded by genuinely riveting news. At a dusty town in south-central Spain called Alarcos, a Saracen from Morocco named Abu al-Mansur defeated an army under Richard's brother-in-law, King Alfonso of Castile. The alarmed West no longer had time or tolerance for the struggle between Capets and Plantagenets, who sat down yet again to try to fashion a peace that might last more than a few weeks. On paper, they did their best. Philip would give back the castle seized while Richard had been in Germany, along with several conquered provinces. The Vexin, a sore spot for generations, would go back to the Plantagenets. Philip would get the promised 20,000 silver marks owed since Richard's captivity. Philip would also publicly disavow any accusations that Richard had been involved in Conrad of Montferrat's death. Philip's son Louis, now 7 years old, was to marry Richard's niece, Eleanor of Brittany, the older sister of Arthur, who'd been declared Richard's heir by Richard back in the days on Sicily. Aged 11, the lovely little girl would come to be known as the Fair Maid of Brittany, a historic beauty who would go on to have extraordinarily bad luck at love. Despite the very real emergency in Spain that drove these negotiations, it's doubtful anyone held much hope that they'd succeed where so many, many others had failed. Everyone tampered with the terms. Richard took it upon himself to insist that Emperor Henry of Germany, his liege lord, approve the deal, which made the French intensely suspicious. And Philip wasn't idle either. At the ripened age of 35, poor Princess Elise, who'd been so unceremoniously dumped by Richard, was finally wed to a young French noble, the Count of Ponthieu. Philip accordingly handed over her dowry, which happened to consist of territory he had just promised to return to Richard. We do have to take a moment to give Elise a little attention, certainly more than due to her by now. Her marriage to the Count accomplished in a small way what any marriage of Elise's was always intended to do, provide an asset to the French. This wedding brought Philip Augustus a small but valued block against the Plantagenets, via her husband's lands along the Somme. To everyone's surprise, Elise, elderly for her era, went on to have two daughters. One of her girls would be the grandmother of a lady named Eleanor of Castile. This Eleanor would marry England's King Edward I, so that Elise's descendants would bring the family full circle to the English throne a century later. Elise died in 1220, at the age of 60, outliving Richard, who had dominated her life for so long by 20 years. And so we leave them for the moment, poised around a table, one hand on a quill pen, the other on a sword. We've come to the end of our story for the time being. I am Beckett Arnold, narrating from the book Lion's Forge, adapted for us by the author Karen Markle Knapp. Thank you to Francis Butt for voicing our introduction and so much more. If you like what you hear, please give us a rating, follow our channel, and share us with your friends. Most importantly, please join us again March 24th for the next episode of Lion's Forge. Available everywhere you get your favorite podcasts, including on YouTube with video episode trailers. Visit us on Facebook, where you can ask questions, leave reviews, and interact with me. Until next time, thank you for listening.